Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. Later on in the show, we're going to talk to our friend Scott Mahoney from the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere and Trifles podcasts about the somewhat mysterious gathering known as the BSI Dinner, held every January in New York. It's a gather of Sherlockians who identify themselves as Baker Street Irregulars and gather for an invitation-only gathering around what is thought to be the birthday of the famous fictional detective. But first up, when you go to the supermarket and are there in the fish and seafood section, how can you know that what you might be purchasing and planning to eat is a responsible thing to do in terms of the health of our ocean's fisheries? Or if you're making a wise choice when having that tuna sushi roll, spoiler alert, you probably aren't. Ryan Bigelow is the senior program manager from the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch, which has been helping visitors to the aquarium make better choices when deciding which fish to have on the dinner table. The program began in the 1990s and became so popular that now they have an app that's had millions of downloads. Bigelow joins us from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Ryan Bigelow, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me.
I remember going to the aquarium many years ago now, when I believe this was kind of first coming out, and picking up the Seafood Watch guide and thinking, I need to start being more cognizant of the seafood that I eat and consume and purchase. Could you tell us, when did this program begin and what was the genesis of it?
Absolutely. In 97 through 99, we had a special exhibit at the aquarium called Fishing for Solutions. And it was really our first attempt to try to show audiences what the impacts of fishing could be on the ocean. And as part of that, we made a little table tents. Think the little happy hour menus you see in restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. And on them, they had information about what fish to eat, what fish not to eat. And we put those out in our restaurant, and they started disappearing. And if people are willing to steal things, you know you have demand. And so we went ahead and pulled the science that we'd used for that exhibit, pulled together a guide, and launched the Seafood Watch program in October 20th, 1999, almost 20 years ago.
And it's very popular now. Can you give us a sense of how popular it is? Like, you have an app, right?
We do, yeah. You know, it's really, really grown. The pocket guide that you found when you were here visiting us, we've given out over 60 million of those. The app's been downloaded well over 2 million times, and we've really gone from an organization that speaks primarily to consumers to an organization that does that, but is also working with the world's largest, well, North America's largest seafood businesses to improve how fish is caught and farmed around the world.
And so when somebody uses the app, and we'll get to some of these big issues here in a moment, but if I use that app, how would I use it in order? Would I use it at a restaurant when I'm going through the menu? Would I use it at the market, or all of the above?
You could do all of those things. I think the easiest thing is if you happen to be in a place, pretty easy here, out here on the West Coast, but depending on where you're in the country, if you happen to be in a place where there's a restaurant that has a commitment to sustainable seafood, and they've done that commitment through us, then they'll be on the app. And that's the easiest thing for a consumer to do. Find a business that's made that commitment, go there, spend your dollars there. If that's not an option, then you dig a little bit deeper. What kind of fish am I eating? Where was it caught or farmed? How was it caught or farmed? What's the recommendation for that fish?
Let's talk about just some of the big issues here. For example, let's first talk about overfishing. This is something where, you know, a lot of fisheries have basically collapsed over the last few decades due to overfishing. Is that safe to say that's one of the big issues when we look at what kind of fish should we be consuming?
Overfishing is absolutely an issue we look at. You know, when you're talking about a wild fishery, you know, wild fish, you're looking at a couple of things. How are you impacting whatever fish you're trying to catch? So that could be bycatch, it could be overfishing, it could be other things. How are you impacting other species in the area? You know, if you're catching birds or sharks on long lines meant for tuna, then that's a problem. Is there a management plan in place? Because we've seen time and time again that if there's a natural resource and we start taking it and there's no plan to control that take, then we will take too much of it. And that's not, that, you know, that goes across the board. That's not just for seafood. So the management of that, impact on that species, impact on other species, and those are three of the four that we really dig in on.
And then there's illegal fishing, right?
Yes, yes. And that's a very large issue. So that what we'd be looking at for something like that, say something like a Chilean sea bass, where it's a very popular fish out in a part of the world where there's not a lot of oversight, you're going to get a lot of illegal fishing, and that's going to very negatively impact the status of that species. So that's a very serious problem.
How do you go about scientifically collecting data on all of this in order to, like, for example, I'm looking at my California Sea Watch food guide, seafood watch guide. And so I'm looking at the little color-coded thing you have. You have the green is the best choices. Those are the things I should be consuming. The yellowish orange, I guess it is, you know, it's okay. It's a good alternative. And then there's the red, which is like, those are the things you should not be purchasing and consuming. How do you go about the scientific collection of data to come up with those lists?
Very carefully. You know, I think it's easier now than it was when we started 20 years ago, because we've built very strong relationships with governments and industries around the world. So when you think about seafood in North America, or even just within America, 90% of that is imported. And so if you're going to have a guide for consumers, you need to be looking internationally at what seafood is out there. And to get that information about, say, a swimming crab from Indonesia or a tuna from Japan, you have to have relationships with people on the ground there. So the first step is always to get information from governments, from industry if available, from governing bodies. So I might work with the Japanese government as well as with the governing body for tuna fisheries all over the world. And you get all of that information and bring it together. The real benefit of that is this is information that the industry is behind, that scientists are already behind, and it's very difficult to question the validity of that data in most cases. Once you've brought it in, though, once you've pulled it together and wrote that initial report, we take the additional step of sending that out and peer reviewing all of our science. So our science is the bedrock of everything we do, and we make sure that it is as solid as possible.
Could you give us an example of a species or two, whatever comes to mind, examples of fish that we should definitely avoid, and then explain why?
Sure. Yeah, and I'll give you the two saddest ones right off the bat, for me at least, because I'm a big sushi fan. Right now, there is not a good source for bluefin tuna. So, you know, bluefin tuna, it's that delicious high-end sushi that you're going to get as Hon Maguro or Kuro Maguro in a sushi restaurant. And frankly, the number of tuna left is so low that too much damage to the species right now to take any more out of the water. There's something like 3% of the total biomass, we say, you know, that, you know, if there was a million tons of tuna 50 years ago, now there's only 3% of that is what they're really saying there. But the population has shrunk to 3% of what it used to be. So that's a real problem. And so that's something we ask people to avoid. Another one is unagi, which is eel. Another very delicious sushi item. A lot of problems with those. Almost all the sushi you're going to get, or I'm sorry, unagi that you're going to get is going to be farmed. But we haven't figured out how to have farmed eel lay eggs, and so they take juveniles from the wild and raise them up in effectively eel ranches. And so it's a real burden on wild populations, and we've seen those populations crashing all over the world.
And is the tuna due to just overfishing because it's so popular?
Yeah. It's so popular, particularly in Japan, but now, you know, the world over, as sushi has spread and become really an international dish, that it's just horribly overfished.
Okay, so take us to the other end of the spectrum. You know, you're going with a friend, with me, to say we're going out for sushi. What are we gonna pick so we can feel good about that?
Well, the first thing I do when I go out for sushi is I try to be a bit more adventurous. So I try to get a lot of shellfish. One, because I love it, and two, because I know that shellfish is one of the most sustainable things you can raise. All the things that you associate maybe with bad farming on land, you know, animals packed into tight spaces, all those things mussels love and farmed shellfish love. So, you know, you pack a bunch of animals into a small space. You don't have to give them any food. You don't have to give them any antibiotics. They leave the water cleaner than what it was when you put them in. They're just a really great source of protein, so much so that in some cases they might even be better than a plant-based protein diet. You know, that varies depending on what plants you're getting, but they're that good. It's a toss-up. And then I would start to look at things out here on the West Coast. If you came to see me, I would look for some brown fish. So that's rockfish and a variety of other species we have here on the coast that, frankly, 15 years ago were not doing well. The entire fishery was in a state of emergency, but they've turned it around completely, mostly because fishermen took the lead and said, we have to fix this. So fishermen, NGOs, and government came together, that perfect trifecta, and really turned those fisheries around. And so now there's some really good rockfish that comes out of our waters. It's very sustainable. So those are some good options. Then, if I was, you know, out with Americans who tend to have a, there seems to be a tendency to not want to eat farmed fish, I'd ask people to take that next step and try some farm products, because there are some very good sustainable farm products out there from around the world. They're not all great. You know, there are still problems, but they're, especially if you're getting American farm products, those are great. And just a variety of other products that can be done really well and very sustainably.
What are some of the wraps on farmed seafood that have been in, maybe in the past, or that you hear that where people are? Because I know when I go look in the meat case in the seafood section, and I see farmed salmon, color added, I kind of I don't know. I look for the wild stuff. What are some of the misconceptions we have about farmed fish?
Yeah, and I think farmed salmon is a great place to start. But before we get into that, I think it's really important to note that, you know, seafood consumption overall is going up. The population of the planet is going up. The only thing that's not going up is wild catch. So if we are going to continue to eat seafood, and, you know, here in the United States, that's a choice. In other parts of the world, it isn't. Many people rely on seafood as their main source of protein. So if that is going to continue to be the reality for billions of people, we are going to have to farm our seafood. So I'll often hear people say, you know, oh, I only buy wild-caught American seafood. And that's great. But again, a little bit over 50% of the seafood we eat is already farmed. And the vast majority, 90-plus percent of what we eat in this country is imported. So that solution is never going to work for the majority of the population. It just can't. So wild products are great, but we are farming products, and we need to do it well. So I'll bring it all the way back around to salmon. Salmon, let's say 20 years ago, had a very bad reputation. You know, too many fish in a net. The fish escape. They're living in their own filth. They're being given all sorts of drugs, things like that. And in many cases, those types of issues are still around. However, most of those issues that really give you that ew factor around farm seafood also aren't good business. Right? Fish farmers don't want their salmon to be sick, so they're looking for ways to address that as well. That financially just doesn't make any sense. So what you see is when there's a product like salmon, which Americans love, right? We eat a ton of it. Most of what we eat is farmed. Most of that farm product is still what Seafood Watch would call a red, so it's not all great. But there are green, our best choice, or yellow, our good alternative options for every type of farming. That's good news, because that means that's the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't mean to tell you or your listeners that we're there yet, because we certainly aren't. But we have examples of people who have done it well, and so that's where we need the industry to aim. And more they are, which is great news.
What are some examples of that you know of that are these are the really the good farmed seafood products to go for? Maybe different species.
Yeah, well, the absolute best one is the one I mentioned earlier. Is any sort of farmed shellfish for the most part. That's just a great environmentally sustainable way to your protein. Beyond that, if you're going to be eating a lot of shrimp and salmon, which is what we as Americans have really decided we love as seafood, you need to be more picky. And that's really going to require you to either A, find a business that's made that commitment, or really dig in and find out what you're buying. And that can be a little bit more difficult. But there are other things that are very easy to farm. Catfish is pretty easy to do a good job with. Tilapia tends to be good. It's not always. You should look at our recommendations, but it can be. So you're really looking at fish who don't need to eat, in many cases, a lot of other fish. So your omnivorous fish tend to do better than your carnivorous fish.
How about trout? Because we have quite a bit of trout farming here in California that is also sold in markets. How is that as an alternative?
Yeah, and trout, Arctic char is another one where they're very, in many ways, very close to salmon, and they fill a particular niche. So that's one that I get excited about, because you're getting people away from salmon, which is great, but, you know, let's broaden our culinary palate, if you will, and try new species. So, yeah, if you can find farmed Arctic char, that's a really cool salmon substitute. And, of course, the trout you mentioned is a great one as well.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Ryan Bigelow from the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch program. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's resume our conversation with Ryan Bigelow. He's the senior manager for the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch program. Here in Northern California, a big concern of ours is the Chinook salmon, the king salmon. They're just not coming back in the numbers that they used to be when I was growing up. The salmon runs really collapsed during the drought here. They're coming back a little bit, but they're definitely seem to be imperiled.
Yeah, and you know, I don't have the newest report of that right in front of me, but that's absolutely true. And it's another stressor on fisheries. You know, when we look at the drought and climate change and all these things, it's really changing how, especially fish that cover a lot of ground. You know, your tunas, your salmons, those types of species are having a tough go of it. And you see that more. You know, the best example is maybe Japan, where, you know, you have a very long, thin nation, and the way their fishing rights are set up, you're licensed to catch one type of fish as a professional, but those fish are all moving north to stay with the water temperature that they like as the oceans heat up. And so you're having fish showing up in places where the people don't have the license to catch, nor do they know how to catch the fish. So you have fishermen who are there ready to work, but there's nothing for them to catch, or they don't know why to catch what's in front of them. And so our choices around what we eat are very important, and our choices on how we choose to adapt and respond to climate change are also very important.
What are some of the ways that the Seafood Watch program is directly addressing, like, carbon emissions and climate change? Is that being incorporated into your studies?
Yes. I'm glad you asked that question. This is a very new area for us. We are looking at, right now, we've just started a carbon tool that lets you take a look at some of the carbon footprints of the seafood you might be purchasing. Right now, still a very new tool aimed at businesses mostly, but it's certainly something that you can, I'm happy to send you the link and your listeners can check out, but really showing people how their seafood's carbon footprint compares to things like beef or lamb or pork or even soybeans. So that's very interesting. It also lets you compare the carbon footprint of the food during transport, which is another interesting thing that doesn't get talked about very much.
Wow, yeah, I never thought about that. But that's true. There's definitely a carbon footprint to what fish you're fishing, depending on the fishery.
Absolutely. And, you know, if it's one thing to say, I'm getting fish from China, let's say shrimp from Southeast Asia, that's a very far away. But if they're freezing it, bringing it over on a boat, the carbon footprint might not be all that large. If I'm flying you salmon overnight from Alaska or New Zealand, that's a much different proposition and a much higher CO2 footprint.
Yeah, that's a whole other consideration when you think, I'd like to have this wonderful wild-caught Alaskan salmon and it's fresh, but that's a big carbon footprint.
Yeah, I'd say for most of us, depending on your budget, you're probably not having your salmon flown in, so I wouldn't worry about that too much. And the Alaskan salmon fishery does a pretty good job of freezing their salmon immediately on the boat and then sending it down to us, so it's as fresh as it can possibly be when you get it.
Good to know, because I love that stuff.
Yeah, it's good.
So another thing I noticed looking at the literature from you guys is you really encourage people to go into places and ask them if they are serving sustainable seafood, and you know, just be consumers that are kind of being proactive and letting businesses know, hey, I'm going to support you if you're doing that, and probably not if you're not doing that.
Absolutely. You know, we do, in addition to our work with consumers, we do a lot of work with businesses, and we've seen time and again that one of the top three reasons usually that they've made some sort of seafood commitment is because they've heard something from their consumers, or they think consumers are thinking about sustainable seafood. And so when you talk about a tool like our consumer guide, you know, it's just this little piece of paper. I can only fit a very tiny fraction of all the recommendations we actually have on there. But if I can get someone to go in there and wave that around and ask questions, that's worth a great deal to our ocean and is a really powerful step. Now, not all people are comfortable with going in and ask questions. We know that too. So we want to have it be both ways. But if you have that desire to get out there and ask questions, then we absolutely want to support that and love you for it.
So when I go into a supermarket, like I shop at Raley's, and I hope that's not a commercial, but that's where I shop. And I look at the label and it says sustainable seafood. Can I be certain that that's true?
Well, if we, Raley's is not one of our partners, so I can't speak directly to their commitment, but I would say you want to dig a little bit deeper. It's great. So I think in the case of Raley's, they have a commitment about traceability, that they will have everyone, all the seafood they purchase, they can tell you where it came from. And that's a huge component of sustainability. So that's an important first step. So that's great news. You can go into that store and say, get out your app and check and see, you know, where do their products line up with our recommendations. And that should be really helpful. But sustainability and what it means is a really big question, right? Is that environmental sustainability? Are they considering the impacts on communities? Are they considering things like slavery and the fishery? And I'm speaking broadly here to the whole industry, not just Raley's, of course. And those are really big questions that even our NGO community doesn't have a firm answer on. We work around that by saying our main strength is that we have the best scientists in the world for fisheries and aquaculture science as it pertains to environmental sustainability. Other issues, seafood slavery, carbon emissions, these other things that are a bit broader, we have developed separate tools to address those issues and to talk to those things, but we choose to focus on that environmental sustainability.
Yeah, and when you mention seafood slavery, you're not talking about enslaving fish, you're talking about human beings being literally forced to fish, right?
Yes, and you know it's a real thing, and partially it's driven by our desire to have protein at very low prices, right? I think you could probably say this for all protein sources, but it should be relatively expensive to raise an animal up and then slaughter it for protein. If it's not, that's when you start to have problems across the spectrum. So if we want to have all you can eat shrimp for rock bottom prices, and we want to have that shipped from the other side of the world, somewhere someone is going to cut corners. And one way to do that is to use slave labor or to buy food for your fish farm, your shrimp farm that uses the cheapest fish food possible, which is usually caught by less than ethical.
Well, before we let you go, could you tell us a bit about how you personally became interested in this? When did this first become your role? When did you first start working on Seafood Watch at the aquarium, and how did you get into that? How did you get interested in that?
That's a good question. I used to be a translator. I was a translator and interpreter in Japan, and ended up doing a bunch of environmental events, and realized that that's where I wanted to be. That I really wanted to be part of the solution to a problem that I thought was critical to the well-being of our planet. So I came back to the United States, got into grad school here in Monterey, and fell in love with the aquarium while I was here, fell in love with the city while I was here, and was able to parlay my skills in communication into a position here almost a decade ago, and I've clung on vigorously and won't let them fire me, so I'm still here.
And what would you say is the biggest misconception people have about seafood industry, seafood consumption? What's the biggest misconception that you really try to educate people about?
I think the biggest misconception is that it's a debate between farmed versus wild. I think that's a real distraction from the real conversation. I also think another big important one is that your individual choices don't matter. They certainly do. And if you can take the time to learn a little bit about the seafood you eat, to choose new sources and try new fun seafood items, you can eat really delicious, sustainable seafood for prices that don't have to be exorbitantly expensive.
Okay, so last question for you is, like, what's your favorite thing? What's your favorite thing about working at the Monterey Bay Aquarium? Because that seems like that would be an awesome place to work.
It is. My favorite thing about working at the aquarium, there's two things. Can I say two? The first one is I get to go there after hours and see the animals in silence, and it is amazing. So that's wonderful. And the second one is I work with the most passionate, intelligent people I've ever met, and I love it.
That's wonderful. Can you maybe tell us what's one of your favorite exhibits or creatures to watch there after hours? Tell us just briefly what that's like.
My favorite exhibit after hours is the giant octopus. The octopuses tend to be more active at night, and they tend to move around, and it's just amazing to see. I could watch that for hours.
So you literally are kind of like a night at the museum guy.
Yeah. Yes. I don't get to interact quite as much as I did in the movies, but yeah, that occasionally happens. Yeah.
Well, Ryan Bigelow, Seafood Watch Senior Program Manager, thank you for sharing your expertise on helping us make better choices when we consume seafood, because it really is important that we manage the health of our oceans into the future.
Thank you very much for your time.
After a short break, we're going to turn our attention to a special dinner held every year in New York to mark the birthday of the fictional character Arthur Conan Doyle's original forensic scientist, Sherlock Holmes. Stay with us. And we're back. Now let's join our friend Scott Monty. Scott, along with Bert Wolder, is a co-host of one of the original podcasts, a look at all things having to do with the great detective, Sherlock Holmes. I hear of Sherlock everywhere, and Trifles podcasts delve deeply into all kinds of things having to do with Arthur Conan Doyle's detective and his chronicler, John H. Watson. I asked Scott to join us to tell me about a special dinner I'd heard about over the years called the BSI Dinner in New York. It's an invitation-only gathering for Sherlockians that's been going on for decades. Long before Comic-Con or even Star Trek conventions, this gathering for fans of Holmes has been a way for Sherlockians to gather and celebrate the mythical birthday of the great detective. Monty joins us via Skype from his home in Michigan. Scott Monty, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, hey, Dave, it's a pleasure to be back with you, and thank you so much, as always, for those kind words.
Yes, I always enjoy listening to your take on all things Sherlock Holmes, and there are many things.
There are, you know, and, you know, what's funny is, you know, this character's been around for now, what, 135 years or so, and it's not getting stale. I mean, there's still something to discover and things to talk about every day, every year.
Well, was Will Ferrell not stale?
Well, let's just say there are some people who like to push the extremities.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. That'll be our movie review right there. Hey, well, the reason I wanted to talk to you and reached out to you was I became aware of this thing called the BSI Weekend. could you just real quick in a nutshell, and then we'll get into it deeper later on, what is a BSI weekend?
Well, it is a gathering of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts from around the world, really, that occurs every January in New York City and has been occurring in one form or another since 1934, when the bookman and author Christopher Morley put together a group he called the Baker Street Irregulars. And his idea was to bring like-minded people together who all enjoyed the Sherlock Holmes stories and use early January as an excuse to celebrate, and Sherlock Holmes as an excuse to celebrate.
Isn't early January, is that when Sherlock Holmes' fictional birthday is?
Well, that's the thing. You know, nobody knows exactly when Sherlock Holmes was born. We know the year. He was born in 1854, and that's easily ascertained by a couple of facts in the stories. But as to the actual date, you know, the month and the day, that has been up for grabs. And it just so happens that Sherlock Holmes quoted Shakespeare a few times throughout all of the stories. He only quoted Twelfth Night twice, leading Morley to believe that was his favorite Shakespearean play for a reason. And January 6th also happened to be Morley's brother's birthday.
Ah, well, that's interesting. It almost reminds me of trying to pin down the birthday of Jesus Christ. And I don't want to get in trouble like John Lennon did. I'm not saying Sherlock's better than Jesus, more important. I'm just saying it's interesting.
Well, you know, it's funny because the Sherlock Holmes stories are right up there with the Bible in terms of works that have been translated into just about every language and that have been in print constantly since their first appearance.
Well, let's take just a step back and the term Baker Street Irregulars. So for people that may not be as familiar with the world of Sherlock Holmes through the stories of Arthur Conan Doyle, may not know exactly what that is. Tell us what a Baker Street Irregular is.
In the first two stories that Conan Doyle wrote, A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of Four, there was some footwork that had to be done. And Sherlock Holmes was an independent consultant. And we independent consultants, I am one as well, although I'm not a consulting detective, know that we can't scale. And that if you want to fan out, then you need people to go everywhere and overhear everything and to see things that you can't see. And so Sherlock Holmes, in a stroke of genius, he put the homeless kids on the streets of London to work for him. There were a group of about 8 to 12 street Arabs, as they were called back then, or street urchins, and he referred to them as the irregular police force of Baker Street, or the Baker Street Irregulars. And they were able to go out and, you know, wander through crowds and go places undetected, because who paid attention to children that were just scurrying around on the street anyway, and were able to come back with all sorts of information for him. And he had a whole scale of pay for them. He paid them each 1 shilling per day for their work, and was quite successful with them.
Wow. Well, let's fast forward then to, as you mentioned, Christopher Morley and the formation of, was his, like, his particular club or fan group, were they called the BSI originally then?
Yeah, it was much more informal than it is now. It was really just a gathering of a handful of people, many of whom were friends with Morley, just from the New York literary circles. Eventually, I think the following year, he said that if you wish to become a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, you had to complete this crossword that his brother Felix put together, and a handful of people completed that. And there were really no, in those first years, and again, this is 1934, 1935 or so, there were no official standing processes for the dinner or anything like that. It was just an excuse to gather and drink. And, you know, Morley was an inveterate club founder. Throughout the course of his life, he founded about 300 clubs. And As a matter of fact, outside of the Baker Street Irregulars, the favorite club of Morley's that he formed, that I wish we could bring back, is the 3 Hours for Lunch Club. Sound like a great past. I'm like, you know, we should stop eating at our desks and we should take time away and enjoy the company of others and, you know, maybe a martini or two and just enjoy ourselves throughout the day.
Well, if you have a 3-martini lunch, it better take 3 hours.
Exactly.
Well, what about the current iteration of this? How long has that been going on, or has it been going on ever since then?
Well, Morley kind of let it fade for a year or two and then was contacted by a very energetic and enterprising executive from General Motors, a man by the name of Edgar W. Smith, who was the vice president of overseas operations for General Motors. And he worked out of the General Motors building in New York in the 30s and 40s and 50s eventually. And he wondered if he could come to the next BSI dinner. And Morley said, oh, I'm sorry, we've kind of let that slide, but I still have all of the contact information. If you would like to become the administrator of this, please run with it, do what you will. And that's exactly what Smith did. And in 1940, he kind of revived the group that had been kind of gone offline for a couple of years. And he was an able administrator. And for the next 20 years, he ran the BSI. He put a much more formal process together. He had minutes and notes. He eventually, in 1946, after publishing a number of his own works and a number of works by other Sherlockians, he began publication of the Baker Street Journal, which is the official publishing arm of the Baker Street Irregulars. And since 1946, every quarter, the Baker Street Journal has come out with scholarship that people from all over the world write about, things that relate to the Sherlock Holmes stories.
And give us a sense of what the modern version is like. So when was the most recent one? You just went to it, right?
Yes, January 10th, I believe it was. And, you know, what's interesting is the BSI itself has gone back to its roots of publishing and now actually has a publishing arm called the BSI Press that puts out a number of books. They publish, there's a manuscript series where they take some of the original Sherlock Holmes manuscripts and their essays about them, and you can actually read the manuscript. It's laid out photographically with actual text on each facing page. You can see the changes that Conan Doyle made. There's an international series. There's a career series. So the BSI has really kind of come back into its own as a literary society. And the BSI dinner itself now has formal toasts that, you know, we toast to Sherlock Holmes and to Watson's second wife and to Mrs. Hudson and to Mycroft. There are usually remarks just about the state of the society and of the Sherlockian world. We acknowledge those who have gone over the Reichenbach, that is, those of our members who have passed away over the previous year. We have the reading of a few scholarly papers, and hopefully they're exciting enough not to put people to sleep after dinner. And then we have the honors list, where we welcome new members in each year to kind of replenish the fold. And typically there are about 300 living irregulars around the world at any given time.
Tell me about your first experience at one of these events. When was that?
That would have been, I think, 1995. I was still in graduate school, and I received a letter from the head of the BSI at the time, saying you are, you know, hereby invited to the dinner, and that's what it takes. You can't invite yourself to dinner. You can't just show up and buy tickets. You know, it is invitation only, and nobody knows after you get invited to that first dinner how long it's going to take, if at all, before you actually become a fully invested member of the Baker Street Irregulars, or as you get your shilling, as it's called, because when you do become a member, you get a name, maybe a title of one of the stories, maybe a character, but there's some investiture that comes with a special name, and you get a certificate with that, and an actual shilling from the 1890s pasted onto it. So just like Holmes awarded the irregulars with a shilling a day for their pay, we actually get our shilling when we become fully investitured members.
And what's your special name?
My name is Corporal Henry Wood, and that is a character from a story called The Creeping Man. No, excuse me, The Crooked Man. The Crooked Man, which I don't want to give any spoilers, but there was a young lady involved, and there were two soldiers that were battling for her affection, and one was captured by the enemy and tortured for many years until years later he came back as the Crooked Man, just bent and bowed. But while he was battling for his beloved's affection, he was known as the smartest man in the 117th foot. So I like to think of him in those days rather than when he came back.
Wow, I'm glad you're not all bent and twisted like him.
Yeah. But the thing is that at these dinners, you know, you meet everyone from postmen to presidents and everything in between. I mean, we've got members of the bar who are members of the Baker Street Irregular. There are physicians. There are industrialists. There are artists, musicians, obviously authors, people from all walks of life. And our membership over the years has included people like Isaac Asimov, Curtis Armstrong, who some may know as Booger from Revenge of the Nerds, Nicholas Meyer, who wrote The 7% Solution in the 1970s and later went on to write and direct Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. You know, so it's a great variety of people who all have their own take on things and are all just fascinating people to talk to.
And with the dinner being a kind of exclusive, like I said, where you have to get an invitation, aren't there, though, events around this that, like, if somebody like me wanted to go get all Sherlocked up, they can go to participate in?
Yeah, there are. And this is kind of a byproduct of the fact that after Morley started this group in 1934 and after Smith kind of resurrected it, people would come from Boston, from Akron, Ohio, from upstate New York, to New York for the dinner. And some of them would arrive early, and they'd be looking for something to do earlier in the day on Friday, if the dinner was that Friday night. And there was a fellow from Akron by the name of Cliff Andrew, and he formed this group in 1945 that met for lunch, and it eventually became the William Gillette Memorial Luncheon, named after William Gillette, the actor who portrayed Sherlock Holmes on stage from 1899 through, I think, right around 1930 or so, some 1,300 times. And Cliff had his own group of Sherlockians that met locally in Ohio. There were groups that met locally in Boston and all around. So you've had this local, as they're called, scion societies that have blossomed out of the mothership. And so when people descend on New York for this gathering, they want other things to do. And eventually, this weekend, and I'm using air quotes, which I know is very effective on radio, this weekend now spans from Wednesday evening through Sunday afternoon. So you've got, you know, kind of an informal gathering dinner on Wednesday, where it's just people getting together at an English pub with no program whatsoever, just a chance to see each other and eat and drink. There are folks that walk in the steps of Christopher Morley, take the Christopher Morley walk on Thursday and end up at McSorley's Old Ale House in Lower Midtown. People use it as an excuse to go down to the Mysterious Bookshop way downtown on Warren Street and see Otto Penzler and his open house down there for Sherlockians at the Mysterious Bookshop. And really what it is over the course of the weekend is a chance to see each other again, to be introduced to new people, and to welcome new people into the fold, because this is something that really thrives on people.
And do the people that attend these things, do they dress in kind of costume, or what's kind of the standard fare that way?
Not generally. I mean, you know, well, it is New York, so no one would really look askance at you, even if you did. But there's an alternative dinner that happens on Friday night opposite the BSI dinner, you know, for people that are in town and that don't have an invitation. It's called the Gaslight Gala. And typically that's a more raucous affair. There's singing and toasts and prizes for, you know, competition for prizes and whatnot. And people, in some cases, do put on period costume or, you know, dress like their favorite character from the stories or something like that at the Gaslight Gala.
Well, it's interesting, the whole thing to me. It reminds me of, you know, we think of the original conventions for fans for like Star Trek when those first started and became insanely popular. And now there's just, there's conventions for everything. But it seems to me that this is kind of like the original fan get-together that's much older than any of that.
You know, I think that's a very fair way of looking at it. You know, I saw an essay online a couple of weeks ago that made the assertion that there would be no Comic-Con if it weren't for Sherlock Holmes. And I think there's some truth in that. You know, I mean, there are traditional Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts or devotees. Please don't call them fans. Who kind of turn their noses up at the notion of fandom. But when you think about it, you know, Conan Doyle was almost the J.K. Rowling of his time. I mean, he was insanely successful with Sherlock Holmes, and he tried to kill the character off and successfully did so for about a decade. But the fans, and they were fans, kept clamoring for more. And finally, after his publisher at the Strand Magazine kept hounding him, pun intended, for more stories, Conan Doyle threw out a ridiculous sum of money per story. And much to his chagrin, the publisher accepted his offer and he was off and running again.
Wow. And of course, as you mentioned earlier about the Reichenbach Falls, that was the original time he killed him off. And what was the final problem?
That's right, against his arch nemesis, Professor Moriarty.
Wow. Well, it's interesting to think about this as the original kind of fan gathering. And it makes me wonder, and I've always, you know, I wonder for myself, what is it about this character and his world that has survived for so long and just keeps having these different iterations? What is it about this character that so fascinates and inspires us? Because when I look at people who are forensic scientists, anthropologists, doing, you know, really important and sometimes very tragic work, and so many of them were originally inspired by those stories.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, there's something, I don't know, there's something universal about the character, something that we can all relate to. And look, we're farther than ever away from the Sherlock Holmes stories than we than you know, certainly the first Baker Street Irregulars were. But in the very second edition or issue of the Baker Street Journal, Edgar Smith, who in addition to being an able administrator, was an excellent writer. You know, his prose was just perfect. He wrote an essay called "What Is It That We Love in Sherlock Holmes?" And he called the times that he lived in the half-remembered, half-forgotten times of snug Victorian illusion, gaslit comfort and contentment, perfect dignity and grace. And when you think about it, Sherlock Holmes appeared at just the right time in history. You know, it was kind of at the peak of the Industrial Revolution. It was part of Victorians' desire to use science to separate fact from fiction or to create order out of chaos. And I think that's something that we all look to do. You know, we all kind of bristle at the thought of chaos and people getting away with things that they shouldn't be getting away with. And Sherlock Holmes stood as a hero. And the thing is, Smith actually portrayed him as a combination of things. He said he stands before us as a symbol, if you please, of all that we are not, but ever would be. His figure is sufficiently remote to make our secret aspirations for transference seem unshameful, yet close enough to give them plausibility, right? So in that respect, you know, if you want to compare Sherlock Holmes to the comic books, he's more like Batman than Superman. We could never be Superman because we're not strange visitors from another planet. But we realize that Bruce Wayne, he doesn't have any superpowers. He's just immensely wealthy. And he honed his body and his mind to hew to what he needed to do. And Smith goes on and says, we see him as the fine expression of our urge to trample evil and to set aright the wrongs with which the world is plagued. He is Galahad and Socrates, bringing high adventure to our dull existences and calm judicial logic to our biased minds. He is the success of all our failures, the bold escape from our imprisonment. And I think that sums it up perfectly.
Wow. And as you said, he's the character that makes sure that that justice gets done, which is sometimes eludes the official police. And you just made me think of something. Didn't I see somewhere where there was a piece of art where special counsel Robert Mueller was portrayed as Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah, it was a recent cover of The New Yorker. You had Mueller there in Sherlock Holmes garb, and he was smoking the traditional yet fictional calabash pipe, and the head of the pipe looked like Donald Trump.
Well, it's just you hear of Sherlock everywhere, don't you?
You sure do.
Well, Scott, I so appreciate you spending some time with us to share your love of the world of Sherlock Holmes, as you do on your podcast, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, and Trifles. Give us your quick elevator speech about what those two shows are all about.
Oh, sure. Well, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, very simple. It's like fresh air for Sherlock Holmes fans. We interview notable people from the world of Sherlock Holmes. Maybe they're from the entertainment world or authors or what have you. And those shows air on the 15th and 30th of every month. And then Trifles is a weekly 15-minute long program that just digs down into the stories. So if you want to know more about, can parsley actually sink into butter? And what's a gamekeeper do? Or did Sherlock Holmes actually have an Inverness cape? Things like that. Those are the things we talk about on Trifles every week.
Well, I enjoy them both, but I'm especially fond of Trifles.
Well, thank you. It's very kind.
Well, thanks again so much, Scott Monty, the host of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere and Trifles, along with his cohort, Bert Wolder.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, Ryan Bigelow from the Seafood Watch program at the Monterey Bay Aquarium and Scott Monty from the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere and Trifles podcasts. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to our NPR podcast via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by PRX, also known as the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by Mr. Blue Sky Schofield. Our associate producer is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.